There's an axiom on Wall Street that I've learned the hard way, and that is anything that you think cannot happen does happen. It's not the things that you worry about that get you in trouble. It's the things that you think you know with absolute certainty that you're completely wrong about. Those are the things that get you in trouble. That's the weird thing about life. If you had asked me in 05 what was going to happen to Lehman Brothers, I was like, okay, that stock's 40. It's going to go to 300. It's a very well-oiled management team.
World markets from Tokyo to Wall Street recoiling today as last-minute talks failed and America's fourth-largest investment bank, Lehman Brothers, declares bankruptcy.
3 short years later, they were bankrupt. So I was certain about that outcome, and I was completely wrong. If I was worried about it, the things that you worry about, you usually are making some concessions for. You're usually thinking about alternatives, plans B's and C's, but it's the things you think about certainty. This is the case of Sam Bankman-Fried. You had asked me if Sam Bankman-Fried, who was the second largest cryptocurrency exchange in the world, at 12.5% of the market share, was minting $15 to $20 million of revenues a day, was going to go out of business. I would say, well, that's not going to happen. This guy's well oiled, he's well capitalized, and he's got a great brand name. People respect him all over the world. He's the darling of the cryptocurrency community. I know with absolute certainty that that's not going to happen. And of course, I didn't. And that's the real lesson in these things.
A few numbers define just how remarkable the rise of crypto tycoon Sam Bankman-Fried is. 29 years old, his business just 4 years old, and its value estimated around $18 billion and counting.
They're calling him the JP Morgan of crypto as Sam Bankman-Fried and his dominant crypto exchange FTX swoop in to save the sector in the wake of ground-shaking collapses.
Good morning. Breaking news out of the Bahamas this morning as the world's second largest crypto exchange, FTX, declares bankruptcy. Sam Bankman-Fried, the 30-year-old CEO, has resigned under intense scrutiny and talk of criminal charges.
The things you are the most certain about are usually the things that get you in the most trouble. So you have to protect yourself. I think hindsight's 2010. I think we see way more clearly in 2020 about the past, and we can recalibrate ourselves, and of course we're human beings, so we always modify the past. Remember, there's an old adage that people don't remember the things the way they happened, they remember the things the way they need to. And I think the Sam Bankman-Fried story should be told in a fresh sort of way while things are happening real time, so people can actually remember them the way they happened, not the way they need to. Or to revise history. I can tell you embarrassingly, I'm sort of a Forrest Gump in finance because I have stepped in various levels of shit, including Donald Trump, the whole way. And so when a fraud takes place like this, we do a number of things as a society. The first thing we do is we start blaming the victims. We look at the list of people that were frauded, oh, those guys are dummies, and we write all this nasty stuff about them in the media. The second thing we do is, oh, we knew Sam was a fraud. I mean, come on. I mean, let's cut the bullshit. You didn't know the guy was a fraud. Otherwise, you wouldn't have an account at FTX. So we have this tendency to revise ourselves. I don't want to do that for this podcast. I think it's very important to tell the truth. I liked Sam. I thought Sam was a visionary. I could explain to you exactly what Sam was thinking about in terms of developing his business and developing that exchange. He had a real vision. I thought Sam was quirky. If you talked to Sam or you listened to Sam and you caught his nasally voice, you'd say, okay, well, maybe the guy, you know, had some idiosyncratic behavior, but is he a good guy? Is he an honest guy? Is he an ethical guy? He certainly appeared that way to me. So we can revise history now and we can say all these different things, but looking at it in real time, when I met Sam, I was impressed. I thought Sam was the Mark Zuckerberg of crypto. I didn't realize he was the Bernie Madoff of crypto. I thought that this guy was a young man who was shattering the totems of the old financial network, the old school way of doing things. This is a story that has elements of human tragedy in it. It's a story that has elements of nefariousness and heartbreak. But it's a human story. It's not just this cookie cutter, here's a bad guy that went out and did bad things and let's put him in jail. There's a lot of layers to this story. There's a lot of contextual things that have happened that need to be addressed. I'm Anthony Scaramucci. I have a 35-year career on Wall Street. I built two businesses as an entrepreneur. I'm the founder and managing partner of Skybridge Capital. We're here today talking because people are fascinated with the new technologies that are a part of our world now, known as the blockchain or cryptocurrencies. And we're here today because of the introduction of those new technologies. You sometimes get fraudsters, malevolent actors, and you get a series of things that go wrong, miscreants, if you will. That happened with the robber barons in the 1890s. It happened in the phone system when it got started. You can point to the dot-com crisis in the year 2000, where there was fake and phony accounting. Unfortunately, where there's money and opportunity, there are con artists and different types of shenanigans. It's a lesson. If you're listening, you can learn it by example. And you can learn it by other people's mistakes. Hopefully you don't have to learn it the way I learned it.
In what some are calling an existential threat to the crypto industry, FTX, the world's second largest cryptocurrency exchange, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, with well over 100 companies wrapped up in the filing, including its failed trading arm, Alameda Research.
So I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood outside of New York City on Long Island in a town called Port Washington. For people that know Port Washington, there was a large sand mine there. It got started in 1905. It closed in the year 2000. My dad spent 42 years working there, primarily as a crane operator. And so I had this interesting blue-collar, middle-class life. Went to the public school there. It was a fairly affluent area, so it was a good public school system. I'm a direct beneficiary of that. And I went out of Tufts and Harvard, but one of the problems with Tufts and Harvard is they were private schools that had very large tuitions. And so, small by today's standards, but, you know, I think Tufts was $24,000. Harvard was like $31,000 or $32,000. It was a staggering amount of money because my dad was more or less making about $30,000, $35,000 at the time. So I got gravitated to finance because I thought it could very quickly pay my law school and my undergraduate school debt. I thought the law was very boring. I mean, I think I only learned two things in law school, frankly. One was, don't be a lawyer. And the second thing was to avoid lawsuits. The good news about Harvard, it was a fairly interconnected community, the university. I crossed the river over to the business school, and I went to the career resources area. And I said, okay, I hate being a lawyer. I'm going to take some courses here at the business school, and I'm going to try to figure my way into a corporate job. I chose Wall Street as a profession. I'd like to tell you that there was deep thought in that, but it was actually quite shallow. I wanted to make money to pay off my school debt. And I went to a lecture by David Darst. He was an institutional salesman from Goldman Sachs. He was 39 at the time. He's 77 today, just give you how long ago it was. And he had this very inspiring lecture about the world of finance and Goldman Sachs and what made Goldman so successful. And I read some newspaper articles and an institutional investor article about Goldman in the mid-80s and fell in love with the place. And so I put in my resume and I made some effort, called people there, asked to be interviewed, met people inside and outside of Goldman, and I got rejected from Lehman Brothers. I got rejected from Credit Suisse, First Boston at the time. But I got a job offer from Goldman Sachs in my third year at law school. I did something very foolish, which I don't recommend to young people. I took the cool job. I took the job that I thought, due to my insecurities, was going to impress my friends. And so I wanted to go to that very famous year-end cocktail party at Harvard, where people sat around in their stupid Brooks Brothers sports coats and turned to each other and bragged about where they were clerking or bragged about what job that they had. And at that time, investment banking was cool and real estate was cool. And so I was going to be a real estate investment banker at Goldman. And so I accepted the job. and I went to work there on August 14th, 1989. So I had written down in my journal, I graduated from Harvard Law School June 8th, 1989, and I had written down a couple things in my journal. The first thing I wrote was that the day that I pay off my law school debt will be the day that I start my own business. Problem is, I absolutely sucked at that job. Obviously, I was a hard worker, I had a good attitude, I just wasn't good at that job. And so when the recession came, they fired me. I got my ass fired at Goldman Sachs 18 months after I started, very first, 1991. Very painful day for me. That was a Friday. You can look it up in your almanac. I went home. I said, okay, what am I going to do? I got two rolls of quarters. There were no cell phones back then. And I took the train back into the city. Had a roll of quarters at a payphone in Grand Central Station. I was pumping quarters into the phone, calling people, trying to find a job. But here's a lesson to young people. When you get fired like that, be nice to the people that are firing you. One of my buddies said, well, there's a job opening at Goldman Sachs. I said, you got to be shitting me. He says, yeah, no. I said, well, where is it? He says, in the sales area. I said, okay. So I then called my old boss who had just fired me on Friday. He picked up the phone. He must have felt really bad for me. I said, listen, there's a job opening in the sales area. I got fired on the 10th floor. This job was on the 29th floor. I said, would you be willing to consider hiring me again or referring me to the partner in charge of that area? And he said, yes, I would be willing to do that. And he went upstairs and he talked on my behalf to the person upstairs and they rehired me. I got fired from Goldman Sachs on February 1st. I got rehired on March 28th. Turned out I happened to love the area that I went into, which was asset management. I sucked at the investment banking part of it, got fired, but I was doing reasonably well on the asset management side because ultimately what asset management is the business of understanding other people's businesses, and it's fascinating for me. But to make the story really funny, the personnel manager from Goldman called me and said, hey, how you doing? You remember that $11,000 check that we gave you? I said, yes. She said, well, let me give you good news. We're not going to mark you down as fired. We're just going to say that this was an interdepartmental transfer. Could we get the $11,000 back, please? And I was so poor. I looked there. I was on the phone, but I said, hey, I said, Joseph, I'm sorry. I said, I've already spent the money. Okay. I can't give you the money back. No. So if you want to mark me down fired, totally fine with me. You can tell the whole world I got fired. I don't care. She was very nice, though. She marked me down as an interdepartmental transfer. I probably made history at Goldman Sachs. I was the only person to get fired and rehired and keep the severance check, but that was fine. But now I'm in the sales area. I was doing well there. And we were in a bull market. Remember, I was a young boy coming out of Harvard in a supposed old boys network. But let me tell you something. When you're a young boy in an old boys network and you don't know anybody in the network, it's no network. And so I was at Goldman. They put me in the high net worth sales area. And I was trying to build relationships and I was trying to foster connectivity with wealthy individuals in the network. There was one way to do that back in the late 90s, and that was through politics.
Campaign headquarters, can I help you, please?
I'm a Republican, lifelong Republican. Why? My dad's union was controlled by the Republican Party out in Nassau County. For the old school people that listen in, Joe Margiotta was probably the most powerful Republican county chairman in the United States. He was a very tight guy, and he had influence over the unions. He had influence over the contractors. And so when I registered to vote, I turned to my pops. I said, am I a Democrat or a Republican? He said, no, you're a Republican. Okay, so it's a weird fact that, you know, most of the unions are controlled by Democrats. That's how I became a Republican. And so I wrote my first check in 1989 when I joined Goldman Sachs to Rudolph Giuliani.
David Dinkins doesn't know the way forward for New York City. To Rudy Giuliani, the future is clear.
It was a $250 check, Rudolph Giuliani for mayor. I was 25 years old. He lost that election to David Dinkins. So now I'm hired and fired and then rehired, and now I'm in the private wealth area. Rudy is at White & Case. I'm becoming friends with him, and he is introducing me to people that are helping me grow my business. We then go for the election again in 1993, and Rudolph Giuliani wins, he becomes mayor of New York. I'm 29 years old, and the whole city's opening up to me. I had the parking thing. I mean, I could park in front of a fire hydrant, park on two wheels. I mean, it was a lot of fun to be tight with the mayor. And so in 1994, Rudolph Giuliani, he introduces me to George Pataki. And George Pataki is going to run against Mario Cuomo. So now Giuliani introduces me to Pataki. I'm working for Pataki. And then Giuliani, because he's gugutz, which is an Italian expression for crazy, he breaks from Pataki and he endorses Mario Cuomo. Why does he do that? He thinks Cuomo's going to win the election. So Pataki and I are looking at each other like, you know, Rudy was always crazy, just so you know. He just manifesting more obvious craziness today than he was back then. But, you know, and I love Rudy, and I'll always speak highly of him. But anyway, make a long story short, Governor Pataki wins the election in 94. And so now I have a relationship with the mayor of New York. I have a relationship with the governor. And I'm in Republican Party state and local politics. And it's a lot of fun for me, and it's helping me grow my business. Never confuse brains with the bull market, but my partner and I that were running our private client team, we elected to leave in December of 1996 to start our first business. I left Goldman Sachs out of sheer and complete stupidity and overconfidence. And if you'd asked me why, well, my dad was a blue-collar guy. He was subjected to the vagaries of the economy, his foreman, and his hours. And I didn't want that to happen to me. I wanted to be able to control my own destiny. You know, that expression, control your own destiny or somebody else will. And I thought, okay, I got to have my own business. I think what happens to you in life when you're a kid, you're impacted by your environment, you're impacted by your family and what's going on in your family situation, and also your personal brain chemistry. But for me, there was a lot of economic anxiety in the house. And my dad was a very hard worker, but because he didn't go to college, he had limited skills. He was always up against it. Cyclicality of the markets, recessions, ups and downs of the construction industry. And so I wanted to have my own business. Come hell or high water, I wanted to have my own business. And so I paid off the school debt, Memorial Day weekend, 1996. And I turned to my business partner. I said, okay, I'm ready to go. My net worth is approximately zero, although I had a small mortgage on this very small house in Manhasset. I said, let's go. And so I took a seven-figure salary pay cut. I was making probably $1.3 million a year in 1996, fiscal year end. Started on December 1st of my own business and went from $1.3 million to zero to get the business started. When you go from a place like Goldman Sachs, where if you have an IT problem, you call the tech guy. If you have a compliance problem, you call the compliance guy. If you have a legal issue, you call the legal guy. And now you're on your own, and you're buying the Pitney Bowes machine, and you're weighing the letters and putting the stamps on them, and you are trying to figure out the best tech solution, and you're trying to figure out the best legal solution to the various regulatory problems that you're faced with as an investment manager. It's a very daunting and a very scary feeling. So you go from being myopically focused on money management to, yes, that's your job, money management, but you have to worry about all of these other things. And so I can remember we were doing pretty well. It was the end of 1997, and somebody came to see me from Goldman. And they said to me, oh, man, this is great. You're running your own business. You're king of your own destiny. You got your own clients. I'm going to leave Goldman. And I looked at the guy. I said, okay, you're going to leave Goldman? I said, can I show you where my summer house is? Do you mind? He goes, oh, yeah, where's your summer house? In the Hamptons? I said, come here, come with me. And I walked him down the hall, and I opened up the closet, and I showed him the server farm. And, you know, it was probably $750,000 of servers. It's back in 1996, 97. It was a lot of money. I said, okay, if you're willing to put your summer house, your summer rental, the house you own in the Hamptons, into the closet, then you should leave Goldman. But if you're not willing to do that, you probably should stay at Goldman. And the point I was making to him is I had to invest all my excess cash flow, all my savings into the business to get the business scaled and up and running. You don't have to do those things at big corporations. And so I learned all that stuff the hard way, unfortunately. We were in a bull market. And so entrepreneurs that are being honest with themselves, they are working hard, but they need a few things to break their way. I have a whole cavalcade of clients that come with me. The market broke our way. We had an extraordinary year in 1997. We had a pretty decent year in 1999. I was heavily involved in the dot-com bubble. I was trading the underwriting calendar and all the new issues and all the IPOs, and we had a very big position in a lot of technology companies. And in March of 2000, the entire NASDAQ cracked. I think we were over 5,000. I think we got as low as 2,300. We were probably down 60 to 70% on certain names, 80% on other names. We watched Amazon.com go from like 116 to 8 or 9. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but we can find them if we want to look it up.
The closing bell today signaled the all-too-welcome end to a market session with few, if any, historical precedent in the U.S. markets as battle-weary traders filed out amidst mounting losses.
I remember being absolutely and totally devastated. And I was a younger guy at the time. I was 36 when that happened. And I looked at the landscape of the whole thing and I said, oh my God, what a mistake to be in technology. And then I had friends of mine in Silicon Valley where they were firing people left and right. And I would go out to Sand Hill Road and you could literally shoot a cannonball through these venture capitalist offices because of this crash. I said, oh my God, I got this totally wrong, this bubble mania, tulips, you know, the madness and the delusion of crowds. How could I get this so wrong? And Warren Buffett was preaching that, now you get to see who's naked, you know, when the tide moves out and you get to low tide, you get to see who's swimming half naked, meaning there's a lot of stupid people that got caught up in the frenzy. And I counted myself among the stupid people. I was beaten. I was bloodied. I was, I saw my net worth drop by about 45%. And so that's somewhat scary. And you get nervous about your lifestyle and the management of your lifestyle. But I got through it. And I think what you learn is that, unfortunately, we live in a boom-bust cycle. You can blame some of it on the Fed, of course, but you can blame some of it on the natural cycle of the earth and the way human beings operate. And you can look at stock market activity measured over several hundred years, or you could look at the 5,000-year continuum of human history, and we do lurch forward and make great progress, and then we recede and cause war or craziness, and then we stop the war and craziness, and we lurch forward again. And by and large, it's a jagged line, but it's a jagged line ascending. It's not a smooth 45-degree angle like we would like it to be in our normative dreams, but it's a, you know, jagged line upward of reasonable to steady progress. And I think what you learn is you have to stay in there. Even when times are dark, and even when you can feel it in your gut, the fear, you have to stay in there. But here's what I would tell you. If you had the stomach to absorb that volatility, many of my friends said, I am done. I touched that stove. I singed my hands. I am done with tech. I'm done with the technology stocks. I don't believe in Web 1. Wasn't called that at the time. We're calling it the internet, but I am done. If you did that, that was a bigger tragedy because you missed the greatest investment thesis in U.S. economic history. The last 22 to 23 years in technology have been an amazing success story. These companies went exponential in terms of their growth, whether it was a Facebook, a Microsoft, a Netflix, a Google, Amazon. You pick the name if you had the stomach or the gumption to stay in it. Of course, for your smart Wall Street listeners, they know that Google went public in 2004, but you get the point that I'm making. If you just stayed in tech, you did very, very well. Now, one of the things that you need to know about money is that money affects us in the weirdest possible way, because remember, what are we doing to make money? We're giving up the most important currency that we have. That's our time. We can't replace the time. We can't make new time. We're living in this time capsule. It's decaying on us. We don't know if we're going out at age 20, 40, 60, 80, or 100, but we're going out and it's decaying on us. And so, but we're giving up our time and we're sacrificing our time for money. So when the money shows up in our bank account, we're like, oh my God, I just gave up my time here on planet Earth for that. That's super, super important to me. So we're affected psychologically by it. We don't like losing it. It panics us, okay? And it causes us to think the weirdest things and the most depressive things, and we start to panic about our lifestyles and our status and, oh my God, how am I going to show up at the country club and tell people I lost my money? I don't want to disgrace my family. And so what ends up happening is that we start losing money, we panic, and we usually sell out at the bottom. And then we sit there and we lament as it's going back up. We say, oh shit, I'm missing this, and we have FOMO. Okay, so we're biologically designed to do the exact opposite thing that we're supposed to do. Okay, and this is the features of our atavism that got us to where we are today. And so a good money manager trains themselves to think the opposite of their flight and fight responses. And so I tell people, if you're going into the Marine Corps, you go to Paris Island. It's 8 weeks on Paris Island. They beat the living daylights out of you. When you show up and a gun is fired, you're running from it. At the end of the 8 weeks, when you show up and the gun is fired, you're running towards it. Okay, and it's about battling your fear, training yourself to go in the opposite direction of the crowd. And so stocks are not like chopped meat at the supermarket. When the chopped meat goes on sale at the supermarket, people run in to buy it. But when the stocks go on sale, people panic and they run away from it. And so you have to learn this if you really want to be a good investor. You have to have the guts to go towards things that look like dog shit and away from things that look overpriced. Very, very hard to do. Neuberger Berman liked what we were doing. We were well on our way to having a nice sized business, and they liked our client base, and they bought the company in 2001. I went on to work at Neuberger Berman. That's who bought the company. Neuberger got sold to Lehman Brothers, so there was some irony there. I had gone from Goldman into my own company out to Lehman Brothers, and they were good people. I liked them, but I wanted to start my own business again. I had the itch for entrepreneurship. I think once you've been infected by the disease, the virus, the bug of entrepreneurship, you're always affected by it. And so Lehman was a great place. I think very fondly of Lehman. It was a well-managed place. There were nice people. So first-class organization. But what I didn't like about Lehman, it wasn't mine. You know, I wasn't running Lehman. I would like to go from zero to one again. I'd like to start something from absolutely nothing and see if I can make it again. And so I went to Dick Fuld, and I said to Dick that, hey, I want to start my own business again. And he was great. He said to me, okay, listen, you got to make it till the end of 2004. If you do that for us and help us fulfill these sales goals and other things, I'll help you with that business. And so you got to the end of 2004. He well compensated me, fairly, I might add. And he gave me $10 million to start the business. I got $25 million from the computer entrepreneur, Michael Dell. And I put my own money in. And we raised a $330 million fund to start this company known as SkyBridge. Closed that fund in October of 2005. And so then again, I went from making no money to a lot of money, sold the business, made good money. And I'm at Lehman Brothers making good money. I went to zero again. I made no money in the year 2005 to build the business. If you had said to me that in 2008, Lehman was going to go out of business, but SkyBridge would still be in existence, I would have never believed that. But that's what happened. We're sitting here 18 years later. It's a great business. So SkyBridge is a diversified asset management company. We have a fund of funds that gives money out to hedge fund managers. And so we like to call ourselves the hedge fund manager for every dentist in America. We have a $25,000 to $50,000 minimum. If you have $1 million of net worth and you want some hedge fund exposure, you can outsource that to us. We can be your CIO and your risk manager. So that's one component of our business. We have a private equity component of our business where we go into the marketplace and we buy for our clients different companies that we think have really good long-term prospects that are going to go public. We have a cryptocurrency fund. We have a Bitcoin fund. We have a ETF. The symbol is CRPT. It's a digital economy and innovation fund. It's all publicly traded securities that are tied to Web3. So all told, our collection of assets are about $3.4 billion. Of course, if you asked me that question at the end of 2021, it was $4.5 billion, but we got our asses kicked in 2022. It's a tremendous amount of hard work, but there's also, unfortunately, because we're talking about markets, There's only so much under my control. If we're in a bull market, the firm's going to do way better than if we're in a bear market. We've taken the position that we're going to be directionally long, meaning we're going to be biased towards the markets, primarily because if you look at 125-year history of the S&P 500, the stock market goes up 4 out of every 5 years. And if you just stay invested, that's your best thing. You know, if you try to time the market or you leave the market, I can show you charts where if you're out of the market for the 10 best days, you have a 2% return. If you just stay invested, you'll have a 7% return. So it requires a cast iron stomach to do that. And so I think we're a good repository for people because we're very long term. We have long term lockups by and large on a lot of our businesses, and that keeps people from doing something emotionally charged at the wrong time. So I got into politics because of business. It was very good for business. And where I made my mistake, and it was particularly a damaging one, is I crossed the line into politics. I raised money for Obama. I did that because we were contemporaries, and my friends in law school knew him well and were fond of him. I didn't really know him. Extremely talented guy. You know, not my policies, to be totally candid. I went and saw him, and I said, hey, you know, I've got a big check for you. I'm going to lie. Is it okay if I lie to everybody and tell everybody I knew you from law school? And Obama looked at me. It lit up. He had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy. And Obama looked at me and said, hey, man, if you double the amount of the check, we could take it back to Hawaii. And so I ripped up the check very dramatically, and I doubled the check, and I handed it to him. And so I raised Obama probably 150 grand. You know, that was a big number back in 2008. He's a worthwhile adversary intellectually, but I do think he caused Donald Trump. There's no question about that. He should have just stayed as a Republican Party fundraiser. Once Trump won, he wanted me to go work for him. I should have said no, and I made a mistake.
Amidst talk of a high-level job in the Trump administration, hedge fund manager turned Trump advisor Anthony Scaramucci has announced a lucrative deal to sell his company SkyBridge to a little-known Chinese conglomerate. We bring in Chase James, who has been reporting the story. Chase?
Thanks, Alice. Anthony Scaramucci, the outspoken Wall Street operative and Republican fundraiser who has been in consideration for a number of top White House jobs, has arranged to sell his company to a pair of firms, China's HNA Group and Ron Atlantic, in a deal valued somewhere between $200 to $230 million. Where it gets really interesting, very few people have ever heard of Ron Atlantic before.
I got the company sold for $250 million. The Chinese are buying the company. That was actually not even the highest bid I had. I had a higher bid. It was an American private equity firm that wanted to fire all my people. I didn't think that was fair to the people that have helped me build the company. So I took the second highest bid and eventually got blocked by CFIUS. But my idea was, you know, decent amount of money, particularly for a person like me. He was not my first choice for president. He was not my second choice for president. I was with Scott Walker. Scott came out of the race. I then migrated to Jeb Bush. Jeb came out of the race. I had a handshake with Donald Trump that if both those guys got knocked out, I would join him. He called me after Jeb came out of the race in South Carolina. And I got intoxicated about the notion of working on a high-profile campaign that was a bit zany and very entertaining. And so I went to some tower. I went to see him, and we started our fundraising process for him. And I was flying around on Trump Force One, whatever you want to call it. I did 71 campaign stops with him in 2016. And I met a lot of interesting people, learned a lot about America, and I learned a lot about Trump and his political acumen and his political instincts during that period of time. What I would say to you is that none of us thought Donald Trump was going to win that election, including Donald Trump. I was with him on November the 8th, 2016, and he was talking about taking his plane to Scotland to play golf. He was not thinking about winning that election.
Breaking news. As it is now becoming clear that Donald Trump will win Florida's 29 electoral votes, very big win for Donald Trump in his bid for the White House.
At 2:30 in the morning on Wednesday, November the 9th, he was being elected President of the United States, and he had to give a speech And I can remember the trepidation about the speech and the anxiety, but we were all very, very excited. Okay. He won. We did not think he was going to win. And let me tell you something, it doesn't reflect well on me, but it's a cautionary tale for others. And the pill dropped at that moment. What was the pill? The pill was the intoxicating euphoria of, oh my God, I just worked on a winning presidential campaign. I was very close to the candidate, and I'm going to end up working in the White House. And so the Wednesday after the election, Trump turned to me and said, I want you to come work for me in the White House. Now, my wife couldn't stand Donald Trump. I mean, she probably hated him almost as much as Melania hates him. I mean, and that's like way up here. You know, she couldn't stand the guy, right? And I didn't listen to her because I had my ego and I had my pride in the idea and in the self-narrative that I was going to go work for the President of the United States. So wait a minute. I grew up in a blue-collar family, went to Tufts and Harvard. I built two successful businesses. At that time, I thought that business was being sold. And I'm going to now work for the American president. This is like a dream come true. But the American president is batshit crazy. Well, you know what? I'm going to override that. I'm going to try to take a round peg and put it in a square hole to the consternation of my family and specifically my wife. And so, yes, it was a heady time. It was a time of deluded delusion. Because I was smoking too much of the access to power, the aphrodisiac of that power, and I was being absent-minded towards the pitfalls or the potential landmines that I was about to face. It's almost a level of naivete. After I gave my first press conference, which turned out to be my only press conference, one of the journalists said to me, hey, you're great on your feet, you're great on TV, but you're a little naive. I laughed very smugly at the guy. But you know what? He was wrong. I wasn't naive. I was naive to the 26th power. And that's an honest story. I had no idea what to really expect in Washington. You know, I'm a bookworm. I read a lot about Washington, but I really didn't understand the nefarious nature or the cynicism of Washington or how these people interacted with each other. So I ended up taking the job to the consternation of my wife. We almost got divorced as a result of it. So I said, okay, I'll try something new. Maybe I can help the American president. You know, this sounds naive and perhaps overly idealistic, but country's in trouble. Washington is a totally different beast. You know, I wasn't ready for that. I was ill-prepared for that. Got my ass kicked. I ended up doing some things that I regret.